From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
When it comes to Middle East fighting, what's news and what's propaganda? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The war between Israel and Hezbollah is being fought not just on the ground, but also in the media. Both sides are adept at propaganda to persuade the other side is losing and to influence the ideas and images reported in the rest of the world. Israel bombards southern Lebanon with phone calls, emails, and leaflets, and Hezbollah provides escorts for Western reporters. On To the Point, how do mainstream newspapers, radio, and television stations sort it all out? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the Federal Reserve's latest action on interest rates. First up, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To The Point. While Israel and Hezbollah make real war on each other, they're also fighting a virtual war of ideas and images. On To The Point, we'll hear about propaganda on both sides and ask how the mainstream media figure out what's true and what's false. On Reporter's Notebook, the latest on interest rates from the Federal Reserve. First, this news update. It's been another day of Israeli bombs, Hezbollah rockets, and heavy ground fighting in Lebanon. In the latest initiative aimed at a ceasefire, the Lebanese government has promised 15,000 soldiers as a peacekeeping force in the southern part of the country. Mohammed Bazzi is Middle East Bureau Chief for Newsday. He's in Beirut. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
The Lebanese government says that the army is ready. This is not empty speak. How ready is the army, given what it might face in southern Lebanon?
Well, the government last night said it was ready to dispatch these 15,000 soldiers to the south on the condition that Israeli troops withdraw from the towns and villages that they've taken in the past few weeks. The Lebanese army is a very small army. It's maybe 70, 80,000 active soldiers, and this would be a big chunk of the army. It's not very well equipped, it's nowhere near the level of military preparedness as the Israeli military. But Hezbollah has said it supports this plan, so the expectation is that there wouldn't be confrontations between Hezbollah and the Lebanese army in the south. That it would be more of a force that would kind of patrol and make sure that nothing is happening along the border.
Okay, let's hear the reaction of the Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Olmert, who says he finds this interesting.
I'm not familiar yet with all the details. And what is the assistance needed for the Lebanese army? What will be the structure of the forces that will join the Lebanese army? And what will be the strengths of these forces and the makeup of these forces? And what are the other conditions, if there are any conditions, that were presented by the Lebanese government?
Ehud Olmert, the Prime Minister of Israel, back to Mohammed Bazzi with Newsday in Beirut. So Mr. Olmert obviously assumes that there will be soldiers other than the Lebanese army along with them. Is that part of the Lebanese proposal?
It is. The Lebanese government said deployment of the Lebanese army along with an international force. And the Lebanese government said it's even willing to deploy the Lebanese army before the international force gets to Lebanon, since everyone is assuming that it's going to take some time to organize that international force, to get another UN resolution for it, to get countries that will contribute troops. So the Lebanese government is saying it can have Lebanese army, you know, within a matter of even a week or two. They haven't put an exact time frame on it, but having the army deploy fairly quickly.
Israel has made it very clear that it will not leave until it is certain that Hezbollah can't return to the places out of which it has been pushed. From what you've said, it would appear to me that, and also with a gloss on the Prime Minister, it would appear to me that the Lebanese army is not prepared or not able to prevent Hezbollah from doing anything if it should decide to move back.
It's probably not able to prevent them from getting to the border if they decide to do that by force. But people's understanding in Lebanon seems to be that Hezbollah is going to make a political agreement to go along with this plan and to cooperate with the army. I mean, Hezbollah has two ministers in the government, and they voted last night on this plan, and they voted yes. And so that means Hezbollah accepts the plan. And you know, domestically in Lebanon, if this plan happens and if the military is deployed, and then if Hezbollah does something to challenge that and gets into a confrontation with the military, I mean, that can cause serious political problems domestically in Lebanon. It can cause problems for Hezbollah being part of the government. I mean, that would have many ramifications beyond, you know, the actual battleground in the south.
So this would appear, then, to be a real step. What's the next step? Will it have to come from Israel, do you think, or will it be at the United Nations?
I think the Lebanese are waiting for the next step from the United Nations. They sent this delegation last night, which arrived today, of Arab ministers who are going to present Lebanon's demands for changes in the UN resolution that's happening today and probably tomorrow. And the Lebanese are hoping, I think the main thing they want out of the UN resolution is language calling on Israel to withdraw from the south as part of this ceasefire package.
All right. So that, again, would be crucial. We will, of course, have to wait and see what happens at the UN. Meantime, some real progress in Lebanon itself. Thanks very much for helping us out.
Thank you.
Mohammed Bazzi, Newsday's Middle East Bureau Chief based in Beirut. In a moment, what's news and what's propaganda when it comes to fighting in the Middle East? On To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Alney back with To The Point. Israeli explosives aren't the only things raining down on southern Lebanon. Printed leaflets called propaganda bombs are also fluttering into the streets like confetti. That's according to Eileen Prusher, who's reporting from Jerusalem for the Christian Science Monitor. Eileen, thanks for coming back on our program.
Good to be with you. I'm actually in Haifa right now.
Okay, you're in Haifa. You're a Jerusalem bureau chief, though, so obviously you have to get around. Tell us about these leaflets. What do they contain?
Well, the leaflets are really part of the IDF, I guess you'd call it PSYOPs or psychological operations, and they really are of two different kinds. One is the sort of leaflets that essentially tell people to get out of the villages that they're in and that the IDF is planning to have airstrikes very soon afterwards. There have been a lot of those. And then there have also been leaflets to try to summon anger at Hezbollah, at its leader Hassan Nasrallah, by essentially trying to blame the entire situation on Hezbollah, saying that it's their fault that the Lebanese people are in this situation. And these are consist of all kinds of things. We've seen one that looks like pictures of tombstones with Lebanese names on it. There's also been one that's floating around that has a picture of Nasrallah kind of looking like a cobra, although we haven't been able to get confirmation that the IDF made that. They have said that they believe that these propaganda bombs, so to speak, are an important part of their campaign to try to sway hearts and minds, if you will, to get people to somehow oppose Hezbollah.
Who other than the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, might be responsible if it's not them?
Yes, I didn't mean to suggest that I know of anybody who could be responsible but them, but it's what I mean to say only is that we haven't been able to get any kind of official confirmation that they made ones that were really more of a caricature type, and that's what I mean by the picture of the one with the cobra. I had asked around at the IDF, and they would not comment on those, so I wanted to say that just as a caveat that they hadn't taken responsibility for that one in particular.
There have also been reports that Lebanese are receiving emails and text messages and telephone calls from Israel as well. What's the content of those so far as you know? I know it's very difficult to come up with facts on this.
That's true, but I have been told that they are using all kinds of electronic media, different ways of getting people, essentially, again, to leave their homes. What I did understand from speaking to some IDF officials is that there is a system of a sort of a computerized phone tree where the computer will call up different homes and different villages and tell people to leave their area as soon as possible. Another thing that I should add, I just saw in the past hour on Israeli TV that the IDF had somehow managed to get into the Hezbollah's television station, and when they were broadcasting, to put in images that were planted, so to speak, from the IDF forces, showing pictures, footage of dead Lebanese soldiers, or I should say dead guerrillas, really, from Hezbollah, and essentially saying that Hezbollah has been grossly underestimating the number of its casualties and sending messages such as Nasrallah is deceiving you, and trying to impress upon the Lebanese people that Hezbollah is losing more than it's admitting.
You said that they had gotten into the Hezbollah TV headquarters. Is it that, or are they able to hack the system and broadcast even while Hezbollah is on the air and sort of overtake that image?
Yes, absolutely the latter. It's essentially some way of scrambling the image and putting in their image, but not that they've physically gone into the headquarters.
So two categories, then, of Israeli efforts. One, as you said, to try to get people to move out in advance of bombings, and the other, to try to persuade people in Lebanon that their real enemy is Hezbollah and not Israel. How well does the IDF think its efforts are working?
That question, and I've gotten different sorts of answers. They feel essentially that it does have an impact, but it's of course very difficult to measure on how many people. I think the sense was earlier on in the war, of course we're almost a month into this, that perhaps they thought that they could get many Lebanese people to blame Hezbollah for what had happened, for of course kidnapping those two soldiers. But now it's very hard to judge, and from what I've heard and read, it seems difficult for the IDF to say that it's turned the people in Lebanon against Hezbollah, because, of course, a lot of people are also just very upset at the situation in general, and certainly at the Israelis for the attacks. So I don't think there's any real scientific way to judge one way or the other what impact this is having on public opinion there.
Eileen Prusher, again, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Haifa today. Hanadi Salman is a reporter for the Lebanese newspaper As Safir, has just joined us. Hanadi Salman, thank you very much for being on our program today.
Thank you for having me.
You just heard the latter part of what Eileen Prusher is reporting. What do you know about the leaflets, about the emails, about the phone calls, and what do you think the impact is?
First of all, I have to correct a couple of things she said. I don't think the Israelis ever stopped the broadcasting of the Manar television. We have it on all the time, and they were never able to—actually, I never saw them. Giving any messages on Al-Manar television. They were never sending, they never sent any messages through the emails. What they did is that they do send recorded messages by telephone. They just dial up all the numbers that there are in Lebanon, and then you get a recorded message saying that you should keep away from the areas where Hezbollah has bases or offices or whatever. And they do throw leaflets on several areas in the country and neighborhoods inside Beirut. Some of these leaflets do specify the neighborhoods they're talking about, some do not. Most of them are saying the same thing, just stay as far away as possible from any Hezbollah base or office or building or whatever. Otherwise, to be safe, that's what the leaflets say. What they were able to intercept, intercept was the what I was able to hear were radio messages that came that would cut the broadcasting of Al-Sha'ab radio, which is owned by the Communist Party in Lebanon, and they have the most ridiculous messages one could ever hear. There's somebody speaking Arabic, no accent actually. He seems Arabic, but plenty of mistakes in his Arabic, telling grotesque messages, really. It goes like this: Hassan, where are you? Ya Hassan, come out of your hidden place and let your lovely people live in peace. We all long for the day when all the Lebanese people will have a feast while you'll be running on the roads off to Damascus and stuff like that. And it's really very... we even ran a story on that in my newspaper saying that there's a huge difference between the sophisticated kind of weapons the Israelis are using to kill us. But it seems that they're very cheap when it comes to propaganda. They're used very, how would I say it? Ridiculous, cheap messages.
When they
cannot convince anybody. I mean, it's really ridiculous.
When they say Hassan, they mean Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, one would assume. Do you believe that these are coming from the Israeli Defense Forces? Is there any other possible source for them?
No, actually, all the messages are signed the State of Israel. Even the phone messages say at the end, "This the State of Israel."
What about the leaflets and the pictures of tombstones with Lebanese names on them, the cartoonish depictions of Hassan Nasrallah? Do you think that those have an impact on Lebanese people?
Oh, yeah, everybody's fleeing. Everybody's scared to death from those leaflets. Come on. They didn't even hire an expensive cartoonist to do it. It's a stupid message. And the drawings, I don't know if you got to see any of them, but the drawings could be drawn by my 2-year-old daughter. I feel insulted somehow because they're not spending much money to convince us of their, cause. I think we deserve better.
What about Hezbollah? And if you have any made an attempt to cover Hezbollah and what they're doing, do they also put out propaganda and try to counteract what the Israelis are doing?
Well, I'm sorry to say that Hezbollah, I'm not really sorry, but I mean, for once, the propaganda by Hezbollah is much more subtle and much more smarter than the ones the Israelis are using. First of all, they're trying to be as credible as possible. They never, ever broadcast anything if they're not sure it happened. I mean, concerning the casualties inside Israel, they're gaining quite a good reputation of being credible concerning the what's really actually happening on the ground. They have their own songs and they have their own clips, sending mostly messages to the Lebanese people, saying that they're trying to defend the nation, etc. I don't know if they're gaining much support out of it, but at least they're not being controversial. I mean, they have their own audience, and they already have it. It's not that they're gaining new audience, but at least they're not being, hostile towards anybody.
Well, Hanadi Salomon, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Once again, only able to talk to us for a few minutes, a reporter for the Lebanese newspaper As Safir. Walid Faris is senior fellow with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He's also author of Future Jihad. Mr. Faris, welcome back to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be back with you.
What do you say to what we just heard from Hanadi Salman, particularly about the credibility of the Hezbollah efforts to inform people in Lebanon of what's going on and to try to shape opinion?
Well, she was very accurate when she described what the Israelis have been trying to do in PSYOP, phone messages, and what Hezbollah is also trying to do in its own media, in the sense of trying not to alienate the other segments of the Lebanese society. But again, at the end of the day, this is a war between Israel and Hezbollah, and both are trying to undermine each other's message. However, the hidden part, the part that is not really known in the international community, is basically the control of the message within Lebanon. I mean, in Israel, most of the criticism came to the fact that the Israeli army or authorities are not telling the international community exactly what's happening in the field, which reminds us of the same criticism of American forces in Iraq or elsewhere around the world. The difference in Lebanon is that Hezbollah, of course, is equal in that field with Israel, not telling exactly what's happening on the field. But there is this big area of Hezbollah control of the message inside Lebanon. We get reports from, first of all, the international media reporters that once they are in Lebanon, they are basically controlled by Hezbollah, who takes their passports, take a picture of them. I have a report by Christopher Alberton from the Time magazine who said that the Party of God told him what the message should be. Nick Robertson from CNN does the same. More important, inside Lebanon, when we speak to the Lebanese media, all Lebanese media, they are under the pressure of Hezbollah in terms of the message. That's way more important than just the propaganda. Not having people criticizing Hezbollah on the inside, silencing the NGOs, etc. The New York Times, may I remind our listeners, just issued an article in which they quoted Hezbollah official saying that they would retaliate against anybody who was against them during this campaign. That is something that the international media, especially the public in the States and in Europe, should bear more attention to, that the fact that freedom to criticize the war in Lebanon is non-existing.
Unfortunately, Hanadi Salman of As Safir, the reporter from Lebanon, wasn't able to stay with us long enough to respond to what you said, and I just want to make that clear to our listeners. She's not dodging the question. She just simply was able to give us a very short amount of time. What do you think, Waleed Faris, about what she said about the relative lack of sophistication of the Israeli messages? She described them as grotesque and crude. Does that appear to be the case to you?
Well, if you frame the Israeli position as the entire propaganda machine is only those emails or phone calls, then yes, but the objective of these messages are not really to express the Israeli position. This is part of the psych-op. The Hezbollah people are doing the same by going online in the chat rooms, interfering also in Israeli chat rooms, and almost doing the same with regard threats and as unidimensional as possible. So what has been said describes one side against Hezbollah. What was not described is what Hezbollah does in response. But all of that is done at one level, at the much higher level, meaning you've got to compare Al-Manar to the five TV stations in Israel. You've got to describe how spokespersons of Hezbollah are saying versus the spokesperson of Israel are stating the case. I just put it in where it belongs.
So, in other words, then, different audiences get different messages delivered in different ways.
Absolutely. If you have a conflict, you have it's a layer cake. At the very lowest level of that cake, everybody does the same. They're trying to undermine each other's will and so on. Then at a higher level, you will have a very sophisticated statement by the spokesperson of Hezbollah, and then you compare them to the IDF spokespersons and to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesperson. Then you have the big picture.
Waleed Faris, again, senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, author of Future Jihad. We'll continue this conversation with him and others after a break. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, the Federal Reserve took action today with regard to interest rates. We'll find out what it was on our Reporter's Notebook. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Ali back with To the Point, talking today about Israel and Hezbollah and their efforts to shape opinion, both on the each other's side and with the international media, using propaganda of different types at different levels, according to the audience that they're trying to approach. Earlier, one of our guests, Waleed Faris, said that the New York Times has quoted Hezbollah as saying that it will retaliate against people in Lebanon who don't report the message that Hezbollah wants to see. Tim Rutten writes the Regarding Media column for the Los Angeles Times. Tim Rutten, good to have you with us.
Very nice to be here, Juan.
How, under the circumstances that we have been hearing about, does the New York Times, do other media in the Western world try to sort out what they're hearing, figure out what's false and what's true?
Well, the problems in the New York Times, or for that matter, the Los Angeles Times, which has a large contingent of reporters there, are pretty much the same as they are in any war and when you're dealing with any authoritarian or terrorist organization, and certainly Hezbollah fits both those things. And the Israelis enforce censorship in their military zones, always have, and they feel they have good reasons for doing that. What you do is this thing that you always do, which is that you get as close to the events as you possibly can. You make the compromises you have to do that, but inform your readers while you're doing it. For example, I know that in some places a lot has been made about the fact that reporters, our correspondents and CNN's correspondents and others, going into south of the Latani or around Beirut, are accompanied by Hezbollah minders. Sometimes you just have to do that. We've been doing those sorts of things going back to the depths of the Cold War, when if you were posted in Moscow and you wanted to travel outside of Moscow, you had to take a Soviet minder, usually a KGB person, with you. Nothing new about any of that. The point is that you'd let your readers know. That's all.
What about the message that, in this case, Hezbollah wants to see reported? Are they able to monitor it, and could they make good on a threat against a Western reporter if the message went out that they didn't like?
Well, of course. I mean, let's face it. These guys are killers, and they have a history of kidnapping people. We don't want to forget that this whole chapter in this ongoing crisis began with Hezbollah kidnapping crossing the border into Israel and kidnapping two Israeli soldiers to hold for ransom. Now, they've also done that with American news people, Terry Anderson, you remember, and others, and aid workers like the emissary of the Archbishop of Canterbury and others. These people have a history of kidnapping and of killing. Witness their role in both the death of the Marine barracks there in Beirut, and they were implicated as well in the bombing of the Khobar barracks in Saudi Arabia. So yeah, these are bad guys, they're operating in a pretty rough neighborhood.
How good a job do you think Tim Rutten of the Los Angeles Times, the mainstream media, your paper, and others are doing in giving a fair account of what's happening in this very chaotic situation?
I think it's a very fair job. I mean, fair under the circumstances. People need to be, particularly today, when everyone with whom the press deals is so media savvy. I mean, Hezbollah is a very media savvy organization. They operate actually one of the best TV stations in the Middle East. Now, it's a completely biased and programmatic operation, but it's a very, very competent, very professional one. They're on the internet just like all the other Islamic fundamentalists are. They read our papers. It's all that, and Israel, of course, is a fully modern Western state. So there are two media savvy sides here, and that's one of the reasons. I always nowadays tell people that, just from my narrow perspective, I hope everybody reads the Los Angeles Times, but I don't think anybody should read only the Los Angeles Times.
Tim Rutten writes regarding media coverage for the column for the Los Angeles Times, and as a reader of that column, I can say he does, in fact, encourage people to read other sources. Waleed Faris, let me go back to you at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. There was some disagreement earlier between two of our guests as to whether the Israelis had, in fact, managed to interrupt Al-Manar, the Hezbollah TV broadcast, and put on their own images and messages. Do you have any information as to whether, in fact, they were able to do that?
I have a report, and I have a witness. That's myself, but not now. 10 days ago, the report says that the Israeli broadcast was able to interrupt for a very limited amount of time, probably seconds. The one still that I saw on the website, but that was a few days ago, was that they put some lines on the face of Said Nasrallah, Secretary General. So it did not really take control of the broadcast, but it intercepted it. And as your guest and yourself mentioned before, Hezbollah has a good technology, a very advanced technology of broadcasting.
Listening carefully to this conversation, Ali Abu Nima, he's vice president of the Arab American Action Network, also monitors media coverage of Middle East issues, of course, has been following the media closely during this situation. Ali Abu Nima, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Warren.
How do you feel about the way that the Western media, particularly here in the United States, has been doing? Tim Rutten says it's fair under the circumstances. Do you agree?
Not at all. And listening to your conversation with Tim Rutten highlighted some of the problems. For example, the uncritical repetition of Israeli claims as fact when there's plenty of evidence against them. For example, Tim Rutten repeated the common claim that the attack by Hezbollah and the capture, he called it kidnapping, but I think hundreds of millions of people in the Middle East would call it a capture of the soldiers, was an unprovoked attack. Well, Tim Rutten can go and read the reports from the United Nations peacekeeping forces in southern Lebanon, UNIFIL, which report every 6 months. And since Israel's withdrawal from most of southern Lebanon in 2000, there have been thousands of Israeli violations of the so-called blue line, including the killing of Lebanese civilians, almost daily overflights by Israeli warplanes breaking the sound barrier over southern Lebanese villages, causing terror and fear to Lebanese civilians on a daily basis. And there have also been violations from the Lebanese side across to Israel. But the UNIFIL reports point out that most of those violations have been Lebanese shepherds straying into Israeli territory inadvertently. So that's one example of a claim. Another example.
Well, before we go on to another, does Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the United Nations, by what you're saying, hasn't he made it pretty clear that he believes that, implicitly at least, that this particular crisis began when the Hezbollah soldiers did, in fact, seize, capture, kidnap the Israeli soldier?
Well, these are reports that are submitted by Kofi Annan to the Security Council, so they have his signature on it. Of course, the impression that's being given is that this all started 4 weeks ago, when in fact it started long before that. Mm-hmm. There is a conflict on the border between Israel, Syria, and Lebanon. All of this talk about the respect for Israeli sovereignty and the Israeli border, fine, I'm in favor of that. But why is there no discussion of the fact that there are tens of thousands of Israeli settlers in southwest Syria across the Golan Heights? If we want to talk about restoring sovereignty and moving of national armies to their borders, as we're saying the Lebanese army should be at the international border, so should the Syrian army be at its international border after Israel withdraws from the Golan Heights. So I'd say the other element here is the lack of context, the fact that, again, Tim Rutten referred to Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, as if that's simply a matter of fact and not a political perspective. I would submit, again, that hundreds of millions of people, if not billions around the world, would likely see Hezbollah as a resistance movement. And he talked about kidnappings without mentioning the fact that Israel routinely kidnaps people to hold them for ransom. In the past few days, it has kidnapped the democratically elected speaker of the Palestinian Legislative Council, to add to the 65 other elected officials that Israel has kidnapped without charge or trial. Israel has kidnapped in this conflict a number of Lebanese civilians, including a guy called Hassan Dib Nasrallah, a grocer from the north of Lebanon, whose only misfortune is that his name is similar to that of the Hezbollah Secretary General. Tim Rutten mentioned, for example, the potential for Hezbollah to censor reports. I've seen very many critical reports of Hezbollah in the U.S. and Arab press. He didn't mention that Israel is under complete military censorship at the moment. Every report coming out of northern Israel has to be submitted to the Israeli military censor. The censor is active. That's why we see very few images coming from northern Israel. In fact, the military censor has the power to arrest journalists and shut down publications that, for example, publish wide-angle shots.
Okay, let me interrupt, if I may. Ali Abu Nima, Vice President of the Arab American Action Network. Apart from the kinds of concerns that you're pointing out with regard to whether Hezbollah is a terrorist organization or a resistance organization, obviously there is a disagreement about that, as there is on so many other issues. Certainly it has been reported in this country that the Palestinian leadership has been captured, if again, or kidnapped, however, whatever you want to call it, by Israel. But what about the reports we get of the action on the ground? And if you can separate it, the reporting of detail from what you refer to as context, haven't there been efforts by the media in this country, including Tim Rutten's paper, The Los Angeles Times, to try to get it right?
Well, there has been some good reporting and there's been some bad reporting, and I can pick examples of each. So, you know, you can find something to support any argument, but I try to look at the broad sweep of things, and there I would say again, if Tim Rutten thinks his paper is being fair, and he doesn't talk about Israeli censorship, he doesn't talk about Israeli kidnappings, he doesn't talk about Israeli violations of the blue line that have far exceeded violations by Hezbollah, he doesn't talk about the Human Rights Watch report. What struck me, and I checked just before the program, last week Human Rights Watch published a report directly accusing Israel very clearly of deliberately targeting civilians. Human Rights Watch couldn't find any evidence to support the often repeated Israeli claim that Hezbollah uses civilians as human shields or launches attacks from civilian areas, which Israel and its propagandists are using to justify the high number of Lebanese civilian deaths.
All right, let me on that particular point go back to Tim Rutten. Tim, it has been reported very widely by not only your paper but many others, whether you call it using civilians as shields or not, that in fact Hezbollah has moved its rocket launchers around from place to place and has in fact often used houses or has fired from close to houses in ways that can be detected and consequently responded against, with the result of civilian casualties. Do you believe that those reports are in fact true, and whatever Human Rights Watch may be reporting about using casualties using civilians as shields?
Well, I do believe they're true, and I think that belief is well-founded. And by the way, just to set the record straight, I did mention in our previous conversation that the Israelis exercise military censorship. And the belief that Hezbollah is a terrorist organization is certainly not mine alone. It's shared by the United States government, the government of the United Kingdom, and other governments, including in the Arab world. Not all, but some. In any event, about this question, well, sure. I mean, Hezbollah is a terrorist organization engaged in a so-called asymmetric guerrilla conflict with the IDF, with the Israeli Defense Forces, and therefore they're using civilians as shields. I believe that one of the UNIFIL reports, there was an incident early on where the one of the UNIFIL bases was hit by the Israelis. The UNIFIL contingent there, according to the reports in our paper and the New York Times and in the British and Irish papers, which I saw when I was there not long ago, all noted that this particular UNIFIL unit had repeatedly complained in the previous days that Hezbollah was coming in next to them, setting up and firing rockets. And, you know, they weren't able to do anything about it because of their mandate. So, ultimately, I think that one of the things that needs to be considered here is that, tragic as they are, and they are horrifically tragic, the losses of civilian life in Lebanon are the consequence of the Israeli forces pursuing the Hezbollah terrorists. By contrast, the loss of life in Israel is because Hezbollah fires rockets that are deliberately targeted at civilian populations. Now, that sort of obliterates any moral equivalency here, and we can talk all we want about the Golan Heights and about what's happening in Palestinian territories, but that's not the issue here. The issue is, you know, you can draw a context that's so broad it's devoid of meaning.
And
if you do that, in this case, there's no end to this discussion. The fact of the matter is this all began when these Hezbollah forces crossed the border into the sovereign state of Israel and kidnapped two of their soldiers.
What about the previous behavior by the Israelis, mentioned by Ali Abu Nima, that there have been many violations, there have been killings, there have been overflights with planes flying faster than the speed of sound and so on. Aren't those things also true?
They are also true. And what's true as part of them is that the Lebanese army, which was supposed to have occupied southern Lebanon and enforced some sort of order there, as part of the agreement that led to the Israelis' withdrawal some years ago, isn't there. We're talking now about the Lebanese army moving south of the Litani River, as part of some ceasefire. Well, they aren't there now, and they haven't been for all these years, which is a clear violation of the agreement that led to the Israeli withdrawal. You know, Israel did not go to war with the state of Lebanon. It went to war against an extra-governmental terrorist organization called Hezbollah.
All right, we are out of time. And obviously, as Tim Rutten just said, this conversation could go on for a long time to come because people are coming from very different positions. Perhaps the bottom line is, as Tim Rutten also said at the beginning, that you ought to read more than one paper and look at more one, in this case, one media culture. In order to determine what's going on in a situation as complex as this, where there are so many controversies still unresolved. Thanks to you all for being with us. Tim Rutten, regarding media columnist with the LA Times, Ali Abu Nima with the Arab American Action Network, Waleed Faris, we didn't get back to him, with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, and our other guests as well. Thanks very much for joining us. In 17 consecutive meetings since June of 2004, the Federal Reserve increased interest rates from a 46-year low of 1% to 5.25% as of yesterday. That was the longest unbroken stretch of rate hikes in recent history. In a moment, we'll find out what the Fed did today on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at kcrw.com, keyword To the Point. You can also podcast the show at kcrw.com.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Once again, the Fed, for 17 straight meetings, raised interest rates up to 5.25% until today. Michael Hudson is staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
We see a change?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Have we seen a change?
No, I think that the markets are pretty stable right now. Folks were expecting this and had pretty much priced in that the Fed would keep things steady.
A change in the sense that there was no further increase today, but rather that interest rates are going to stay where they were yesterday. Is that correct?
Correct. So there's basically we're going to stay at 5.25 until at least until the Fed's next meeting. The Fed basically said that they're still being vigilant about inflation, but they feel that inflation pressures are likely to moderate over time.
I was trying to make it sound dramatic, and I think that it is when you have 17 increases followed by what they've done today, which is effectively not to do anything. Does this appear to be something that augurs a long-term trend?
It's unclear because the Fed did leave open the possibility that it could go back to raising rates at a quarter point pop over the next few meetings, and it really just depends on what happens next in terms of economic data, inflation data coming in.
The Fed itself put out a very brief statement on this, just 4 points. I don't know how many words there are in it, but I would guess not more than a couple of hundred. So that leaves people like you, Michael Hudson at the Wall Street Journal, to try to interpret what it really means. How difficult is it to do that, to draw the conclusions that that you have so far?
Well, you know, the Fed's policy statements tend to be the subject of more hair-splitting analysis than any piece of turgid prose, you know, this side of a PhD dissertation on, you know, on Michel Foucault. You know, there's a lot of energy put into, you know, what does this mean? What does that mean? A lot of debate back and forth. But in this case, the Fed statement was pretty terse and, you know, pretty to the point. I mean, they are doing this balancing act where they, you know, they want to acknowledge that the economy is slowing, and that you know, easing back on the rate increases may help the economy have a softer landing. But at the same time, you know, especially folks in the bond market are concerned that the Fed you know, keep watchdogging inflation and not let inflation get out of control, because if they do, it could, you know, people in the bond markets are obsessed with inflation because it eats into their returns, because, you know, they're called fixed income investors. That's because, you know, when you invest in bonds, you're basically saying, I'm going to get X return, you know, for a specified period. It's not like when you buy stocks, they could go, you know, really go up and down wildly.
Once again, reading from the Fed's very brief statement, it does say inflation pressures seem likely to moderate over time. But then in the next line, it says, nonetheless, some inflation risks remain. It doesn't spell those out, though.
Right. Well, you know, we're just in a difficult situation, partly because of you know, rising energy prices. I think we just had some news about shutdown of production, and you could correct me on this. Some shutdown of production in Alaska, is that correct?
That is correct.
Correct?
Alaska pipeline, or parts of it at least, shut down for some time to come. A big impact on the West Coast, which
right.
is the part of the country that gets most of its oil from there, or some of its oil from there, I should
right.
say.
Right. So, you know, things like you know, rising fuel prices can, you know, have helped fuel inflation. You know, there's a lot of argument over what measures to use. You know, some people use the consumer price index. Some people insist that the better measure is what they call the core consumer price index, which throws out energy and food prices.
What about the fact that Alan Greenspan's no longer there, Ben Bernanke having replaced him? Has he managed to get the confidence of the people who need to have confidence in him for the Fed to be effective?
You know, it's a long-term process, because, you know, part of the problem is that when you make these moves, when you make an interest rate move, it really does. It has some immediate effect, but for the greater economy, the effect is very much delayed. It could be months or even a year before you see the full impact of what's happening. But generally, folks, and for instance, in the bond markets, feel better about him than they did this spring. I mean, part of it was just the fact that he's not Greenspan. Part of it is he had what some people perceived as a few missteps early on, including he had a conversation at a social function with a CNBC a journalist who apparently he thought was off the record, but she reported a couple days later on air that caused kind of a stir in the markets.
So you have to be pretty media savvy to do that job, and it does appear he's getting that way.
I think so. I think he's trying to. I think he's you know, Fed chairmen seem to be more effective when they get their news out in controlled settings rather than off the cuff.
Michael Hudson, excuse me. Go ahead.
Because the markets do, you know, just as they parse every line in the Fed's policy statements, any bit of information, any hint, any nuance, any bit of body language, you know, people, you know, on Wall Street are watching very closely, and they're making bets on that. So
So better not to talk to reporters at cocktail parties, I guess, would be the bottom line. We're talking with Michael Hudson, the staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Now, this 5.25 rate is not, of course, the rate that applies to everybody. What is it, and how will it affect other rates, like mortgage rates, for example?
Well, it's basically the rate that banks charge one another on overnight loans. But as a ripple effect, it in the long run it affects the how much it costs for businesses and individuals to borrow and spend, and by raising rates as the Fed has been doing for quite some time now, it effectively means there's less money in the financial system, and it, to some degree, slows down economic growth.
So, in other words, would mortgage rates then be expected to stay as they are, or would there be fewer mortgages because there's less money in the system, or how does that work?
Well, at this point, given the pause, there shouldn't be any substantial change.
So, again, this is a pause. It really isn't a change in policy. It's just a decision not to raise rates further. It's sort of a come back and see us the next time we meet.
Right, they've left the door open, and they specifically said, we're going to be looking at incoming information. And so, what that does is the Fed and everybody on Wall Street is going to be watching every new report about unemployment, inflation, you name it. They're going to be watching that, sort of trying to read the tea leaves and see where the economy is going. And what the Fed is going to do the next time around.
All right. So Ben Bernanke and the Fed have read the tea leaves, and now it's everybody else's responsibility to read the rest and to read theirs. Michael Hudson, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks so much, Warren.
Staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Carmen Radziner and Dan Konecki, our technical director, Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at kcrw.com with the keyword, of course, To the Point. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.